lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, hosted by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Dharma Drum Institute of Liberal Arts in Taiwan. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Lori Meeks, who will speak to us on the topic of women in pre-modern Japanese Buddhism. Lori Meeks is Associate Professor of Buddhism and Chair of Religion at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. She is the author of Hokkeji and the Reemergence of Female Monastic Orders in Premodern Japan, which won the John Whitney Hall Prize from the Association for Asian Studies. She has written numerous articles on Japanese Buddhism, East Asian Monasticism, and Women and Buddhism. At the University of Southern California, she teaches Introduction to Buddhism, Women's Life in Premodern Japan, and graduate courses on Japanese Buddhist texts, among other things.
Hi, thank you very much. Good morning. It's an honor to be a part of this course. I've already learned so much from the earlier lectures. And I know that since we were pre-recording this, there aren't many who've had a chance to log on, so maybe more will join later. I would love to have questions and respond to your thoughts if there's an opportunity. But if not, and if you're just watching a recording of this, I'm happy to take questions and feedback by email. So I thought I would just start out by kind of outlining what I want to talk about today. The original title of my lecture was very, very general. I think it was Women in Japanese Buddhism. So I am not going to talk about everything. I'm going to focus on a couple of topics that I've covered in some research of my own. And I will be focusing really primarily on pre-modern Japan, and especially women in the Heian and Kamakura periods. And these periods I have outlined here on the slide. So the, Nara and Heian periods. I'll talk a little bit about Nara, but mostly I'll be looking at the Heian period and then the Kamakura period, which starts in 1185. And goes to around 1333. So I'll be focusing on the pre-modern period, and I'm going to divide the lecture into two parts. The first part will look at nunhood in the life cycle of women in pre-modern Japan. And basically what I'll be exploring here is the fact, really, that in pre-modern Japan it became an expectation that most women, especially educated elite women, women who had some access to the culture of the court and who were a part of a learned society, elite society, they expected to spend what we might consider their retirement years as nuns. And so what that means, what exactly did it mean to be a Buddhist nun in that context is something I'll talk about. But I'm going to look at this this trend or this practice in which being a Buddhist nun was actually a normal part of the life cycle for most educated women. So I'll explain why that was the case and look at that in some depth. And then the second part of the lecture will kind of shift gears to look at Buddhist ideology in pre-modern Japanese Buddhist discourse. So there are a lot of concepts about women's salvation, about the obstacles that women face on the Buddhist path, and so on, that are very commonly discussed when scholars look at the topic of women in Japanese Buddhism. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time in the second part of the lecture looking at what those actual concepts are, where they come from, and most importantly, or most interestingly, I think, from my perspective, how women responded to them. To what extent can we know how women received these teachings and how they made sense of them? So that's just kind of a basic outline. So the first part of the lecture is this focus on nunhood in the life cycle of women. And most of this part of the lecture is outlined in much more detail, actually, in the article that I recommended for the course or that I gave you all to take a look at. And this is an article from the Harvard Journal of Asiatic Studies in June 2010 called Buddhist Renunciation in the Female Life Cycle. So if you want sort of more detailed explanations of some of these topics that I'm going to go through, the article is a bit more detailed. So I start out in there talking about what we know about nunhood more generally during this early period of Japanese history. So actually in the Nara period in Japan, so the Nara period 712 to 793, there were quite a few state nunneries that were built in Japan. And so what we see during this period is actually the state was building pairs of nunneries and monasteries throughout the provinces. And the idea originally was to have one monastery nunnery pair in every province in Japan. And we know that as a part of that process, establishing these nunnery monastery pairs, there were nuns who were officially appointed by the court to serve in these institutions. They received ordination as full-fledged bhikkhuni. And you'll see here on the slide, this is the Japanese spelling of bhikkhuni, which is just pronounced bhikkhuni. We know that women who had been officially appointed by the court to serve in these institutions would offer prayers for state protection and this sort of thing, and had what were basically official state appointments. However, that system falls away and kind of disintegrates over the course of the Nara period. And the last evidence we have of a nun serving in this official capacity is in the year 773. That's the last documentary evidence we have of a full-fledged bhikkhuni serving in this capacity. So these ordination platforms that seem to have been somewhat vibrant in very early Japanese history when temples were just starting to flourish in Japan disappear fairly quickly. And it's not until the 13th century that ordination platforms for nuns are revived in Japan. So official ordination platforms for nuns are revived in the mid-13th century, hundreds of years later, by Vitsu or Vinaya groups and by Zen groups. And that's really the topic of the book that I wrote about the institution Hokkeji. And I don't know if some of you have seen this book. It's called Hokkeji and the Reemergence of Female Monastic Orders in Pre-Modern Japan. And in this book, I really explore that reemergence of official ordination platforms for women and the role of full-fledged bhikkhuni in medieval Japan. But it's not what I'm going to talk about today. But if you're interested, I hope you will take a look. So in the meantime, so between 773 and really what the late 8th century, early 9th century, when official ordination platforms for women disappear, and the 13th century when they reappear, we have this long period, right, of almost 500 years. And during that period, on the one hand, it may seem like, oh, there are no Buddhist nuns in Japan, but that wasn't at all the case. In fact, if anything, we see that Buddhist nuns become ubiquitous in Japan. It's just that they're not full-fledged bhikkhuni. It's a different form of nunhood that becomes popular, and that is what I'm going to talk about today. These are what we might call lay nuns, which I know seems like a very redundant term. How can you have a lay nun? That's what I'll get into now. So most Heian noble women, so noble women of this period, 794 to 1185, spent the latter years of their lives as what we might call lay renouncers. That is, they were not officially recognized as nuns. They hadn't taken full bhikkhuni precepts, But they weren't lay women. They were marking themselves as having entered a separate phase of life in which they were devoted completely to the practice of Buddhism. And they styled themselves as nuns in terms of clothing, hairstyle. They took on Buddhist names and so on. And so I will get into more detail from here. So before we talk about nuns in particular, these lay nuns in particular, I want to say a little bit about the rise of what we might call lay renunciation in general. So there's this term that's used in Japanese called shuke. It's here on the slide, shuke, which is basically the term that comes to be used as the translation for going forth. So with the Chinese characters, it literally means to leave home. But so it can be that act of leaving home. It can be a verb, but it can also be a noun referring to one who leaves home, a home leaver. So shuke was a very commonly used term during this period of Japanese history to refer to these lay renouncers, people who had renounced the lay life, but they had not become full-fledged monastics. So I define them here saying, firstly, they assumed the name and appearance of monastics. That is, they styled themselves outwardly as monastics. They wore Buddhist robes. They cut or shaved the hair. For men, this would mean shaving the head. For women, there were stages of getting rid of hair, which I will talk about as we move on. And then secondly, they made a commitment to full-time religious practice. So they were devoting themselves fully to Buddhist practice. And one thing I note in the article is that these shuke became very important agents of Buddhist culture, not only as devotees, often commissioning various Buddhist projects like the copying of sutras or the establishment of temples or devotional halls. They also commonly would commission Buddhist images and so on. Some would give tours of Buddhist sites to lay people. They would commission a lot of rituals and so on. So they're very important as agents of Buddhist culture, as propagators, really, of Buddhist culture. And that included the women as well, absolutely. What kind of vows did shuke take? So we know that there were commonly large ceremonies that were performed in which many people would take vows at once or precepts at once. And these were jukai-e, so literally a ceremony or meeting in which the precepts were given or bestowed. And as I talk about in the article here, there are many different ways of taking vows for shuke. Some would participate in these jukai-e, in which many people might take the precepts at once. And sometimes these jukai-e were done as part of a larger ceremony. They were sometimes done by kind of celebrity priests, a very popular priest who might have been coming through an area, may have attracted a lot of devotees who would come and want to take precepts from that particular master. But we know that many people, we have a lot of documentary evidence and kind of anecdotes from literary works at the time that talk about individuals, especially those of means, those that had money to make a donation to a priest, they would sometimes call a priest in private and say, I've made this decision to become a shuke. I want you to administer some vows to me. So we know that there are also a lot of examples like that in which individuals may have taken Buddhist vows kind of informally by inviting a Buddhist priest privately to come to their home, or they may have gone and visited a Buddhist priest at his residence to take vows. We know that many people took vows because there was vast merit associated with taking vows. And we can see this, I believe it's in the next slide here. This is an excerpt from the Xianyu Jing, the Sutra of the Wise and the Foolish. And this is a nice passage from that sutra, which talks about the merit of going forth or taking precepts. And it seems that this is the logic that was really at work when we talk about Shukke in pre-modern Japan, that there was this idea that by becoming a Shukke, even if one wasn't taking full vows and living as a monastic completely, one could create vast stores of merit that would help with one's rebirth in the next life, but that it could also help even with the curing of an illness. It could help in times of childbirth, for example. If a woman was giving birth and things weren't going so well and it looked like she might die, it was very common for a noble woman in that situation to call in a Buddhist priest and have some kind of vow ceremony performed, where she would take precepts so that she could style herself as a monastic. And the idea is that if she were to die as a monastic, she would have great merit that could be sort of put towards her next life, put towards her next birth. So this, I won't read this whole excerpt here, but we see here this idea that the world honored one praised the act of leaving home, saying that as a source of merit, its blessings are extremely great. If you release men or women to leave home, if you release male or female servants to leave home, if you allow the common people to leave home, or if you yourself leave home and enter the way, the merit created by this act is immeasurable. And then it talks about how the rewards of other things like dana or giving, those blessings have limits. But as for the blessings of leaving home, they are immeasurable and boundless. Within the Buddha Dharma, the rewards of leaving home cannot be fathomed. Even until one reaches nirvana, its blessings are inexhaustible. And so that logic, I think, was certainly at work when we look at these early anecdotes or examples of individuals taking vows to become Shukke, or what I'm calling lay renouncers. As I mentioned before, it was very common for people to take vows of this nature during a period of grave illness or in preparation for death. In fact, it seems to have become so common as a means of preparing for death that we can almost see a parallel to the notion that we find in Hindu texts of the last two life stages, ashrama, this idea that you would devote the last portion of your life to a life of renunciation and contemplation, religious preparation for death. So what I've done in this article is to take a lot of examples from various sources from the Heian and Kamakura periods, but a lot of the sources are actually literary sources. So they're not religious sources as such, but they are works like The Tale of Genji and Eiga Monogatari, which is a kind of historical narrative that celebrates the Fujiwara family, an aristocratic family. And what I've done with those anecdotes from these works is to try to get a sense of what was considered normal in this period in terms of people's attitudes towards lay renunciation. And we find a lot of examples in these various literary works from the period of women taking vows as shukke in various situations, so we can get a sense of what exactly this act meant. So my last point on the slide here is that in literature of the period, we see that the moment when someone decides to take shukke, or to become a shukke, is a moment of both relief and sadness. And just to explain that a little bit, there are many examples in the article, but basically, it became a trope in literature of this period for aristocrats to say how much they were longing to become shukke. They just couldn't wait to leave the householder life behind, to leave the politics of the court and all of the difficult human relationships they had to deal with at court, to leave all of that behind and devote themselves to Buddhist practice. So we see this idea of a kind of longing to become a renunciant, very common in this literature. So it can be a moment of relief when one is finally able to take vows as a shuke. Finally, the time has come. I've been working towards this for a long time. I've been wanting to devote myself to Buddhist practice. I've been wanting to renounce the world for years and years and years. Finally, here's my opportunity. So it can be a moment of relief, but then we also see it portrayed as a moment of profound sadness. And typically that is because it's associated with death, with preparation for death. So in so many of these anecdotes, it's made very clear that it's sad to see someone become a shuke because that means that they must feel the end is near. That is that this is a moment of really recognizing the impermanence of life, the frailty of the human condition, and so on. Oh, this person who was once so powerful in court, who had so much political influence and so on, is now preparing for death. So why was death preparation such a big deal? I want to move on to that. So I'm going to skip over a couple of slides and I'll come back to the ones that I skipped over. But basically we have this idea that really stems from the work of Genshin, the Heian period Tendai monk who wrote Ojo Yoshu, Essentials on Rebirth in the Pure Land. And he was a Tendai monk who really popularized Pure Land practice for ordinary people, but especially for elites. So his works became very well known among Han aristocrats and members of the court. It spells out, it's basically Ojo Yoshu explains the nature of the various heavens and hells in the Buddhist cosmos, and then it explains what one needs to do to be born in Amida's Pure Land. And this is not the kind of easy Pure Land practice that we see popularized later on by folks like Honen and Shinran, where you just say the Nembutsu or the Nyenfo, you just say Namu Amida Butsu, and you can be guaranteed of birth into Amida's Pure Land. Genshin's form of Pure Land Buddhism was much more difficult. And he basically said that one needed to prepare for years and years for the moment of death. That the moment of death was this very potent moment, this opportunity when one could be born into the Pure Land if one died in the right way. And so the idea was that one didn't want to squander that opportunity. So you wanted to make sure that you were prepared for the moment of death, that you would be able to carry out the practices correctly, so that you would be able to take advantage of this great opportunity to be born into Amida's Pure Land. If you were to die in a less auspicious way, if you were to die gasping and in convulsions and in a frame of mind that was not calm, that was not collected, you were likely to fall into the hell realms or into the animal realms and so on. And so Genshin talked about various ways that people could prepare for this final moment of death. And a lot of it was about learning how to visualize Amitabha's Pure Land, learning to say the Nembutsu in just the right way. And he actually inspired a lot of aristocrats at the time to band together and to form these communities in which, and these were lay communities usually, they may have been guided by monastics or might have gotten some leadership or guidance from monastics, but they were basically lay societies in which the members of the group would meet regularly to practice their Nembutsu recitations, to practice for that final moment of life. And it's thought that they would even go to each other's deathbeds and help the dying person stay calm and collected in that final moment, stay focused on Amitabha, and die in just the right way. And so it's that background, that context, that helps explain why it would be necessary for people to become Shuke in this last stage of life. So why in retirement would it be necessary for ordinary people to become Shuke? This was because one needed to devote oneself to these difficult practices. One needed to spend years carrying out all of these preparations, really creating this kind of mental preparation for death. And so one example that I think is useful for thinking about this is the example of the nun of Ichijo, which I have on the slide here. So she was the grandmother of Fujiwara no Munetada, a great courtier, and she spent 30 years as a lay renouncer or a shuke. So she, because she becomes a lay renouncer, she's referred to as the nun of Ichijo, Ichijo being the place where she lives. So this is roughly from ages 50 to 80 that she spends her time as a lay renouncer or as a shuke. And her grandson, Munetada, records her daily religious practices in his journal, Chuyuki. So we get this information from a courtier journal. And just to give you a sense of the kinds of things she was doing as a shuke, and these are mostly devotional practices, but some of them require quite a bit of time. So she was making daily offerings to Amida or Amitabha in the prescribed manner, Amida Kuyo-ho. She was undertaking continuous intonations of the Daizuyu Dharani-kyo, so a sutra of Dharani. She undertook the 1,000,000 intonations of Amitabha's name, or the Hyakuman ben Nenbutsu, on 20 different occasions, so that's quite an undertaking. She once per month undertook 10,000 recitations of Amitabha's great incantation. She once per month recited the 1,000-armed Kannon Dharani 1,000 times. And then she commissioned at least 10 Buddhist images and undertook at least 10 tendoku of Mahayana sutras. And these tendoku, this was kind of like an accelerated reading where they would take a sutra that is folded up, kind of like an accordion style, and flip through it like this, and this was considered a reading of the sutra. So this was done in a ritual manner, and the idea was that you would get the same merit from doing this ritual as you would from reading the sutra that number of times and so on. So she undertakes a pretty rigorous set of devotional practices as a shuke or a renunciant nun. So that's just to give you a sense of why people felt that this last stage of life should be spent as a renunciant. It was because one really did need to spend a lot of time preparing for death. And now I just want to look at a couple of examples from Heian period literature of people, individuals taking vows as shuke. So this is an excerpt from The Tale of Genji, and this is from the Royal Tyler translation. So this is a scene in which Onna-san no Miya, one of the lovers of Genji, takes Buddhist vows immediately following a very difficult childbirth, and it seems that she feels she may pass away because she has become so sick during this episode of childbirth. And so she says, "I still doubt that I will live. And since they say that this sort of sin, that is dying in childbirth, is very grave, I think I shall become a nun because that might help me live longer, or at least it might lighten this burden of sin if I am to die after all." So there we see this idea that taking vows is seen as being so meritorious that it could actually help her heal. It could actually cure her. That idea we do see in quite a few examples from Japanese literature and historical records, going far back. In fact, we can go back to the Nara period. There are examples of emperors when they become ill, for example, ordering the ordination of bhikkhu and bhikkhuni, with the idea being that those ordinations might enable the emperor to be healed. So in this example, Onan San no Miya feels that in taking Buddhist vows, she may actually be able to be granted healing through that merit. But if it doesn't work out, at least that merit, she says, may lighten the burden of sin if she does die. So it may help her to die with greater merit, at least, if she does pass away. And then I wanted to look at Genji's response. So her lover, Genji, when he hears that she is going to become a nun, a lay nun, a shuke, he says, "I'm extremely sorry together that my own stubborn helplessness and foolish tears are what made you forsake me like this. I only wish you could take it back." So this points to another very common trope in literature from this period, which is that becoming a shuke, this is probably not surprising, was basically a way of, or could be, among many other things, it could be a way of separating from one's husband or wife. And in the case of Heian aristocrats, polygamy was very common. So many royal men, aristocratic men, had numerous wives or numerous lovers who had a kind of an ongoing status, an ongoing relationship status. So Onna San no Miya is only one of Genji's many relationships. And these are mostly legitimate, recognized relationships that he has simultaneously. And women sometimes had multiple lovers too, but this was certainly a system that favored the men, and it was much more common for men to have multiple wives, and they were tended to be much less tolerant of women having multiple lovers. But Genji, when he responds to Onna San no Miya like this, we can see that he understands her decision to take vows, even though she says she's taking vows because she's afraid of death. He sees this decision as a decision to split from him, as a marker that their relationship is ending. At least their romantic relationship is coming to an end. And this is something we see throughout literature of this period, that when men or women took the shuke, they were signaling the end of their sexual lives, and specifically the end of particular relationships, typically. Now, what's really interesting is that there's a lot of different, opinions, a lot of different views in the early literature over whether this decision to become a shuke was binding, especially when it came to ending conjugal relationships. So in this excerpt from Genji, the excerpt really doesn't make sense, and the trope of a woman becoming a shuke doesn't really make sense in this context unless it's understood as an act that cannot be reversed. If it's not if it's a reversible act, then the pathos of her undertaking what's seen as a drastic measure to become a nun, to cut off her relationship with Genji, the pathos of that whole scene is diminished if this is actually something she can reverse, if she can actually decide, you know what, I'm healed now, I don't want to be a nun anymore, I want to get back together with Genji. If that's possible, then this doesn't seem like such a moving passage. However, there is a lot of other evidence, both from literary examples and from historical records, that suggest that, in fact, there were many times when women might take shuke, especially in times of illness, or to cut off a particular romantic relationship, live as lay nuns for a period of time, and then take their vows back, basically, and become ordinary lay women again, maybe undertake another romantic relationship or get married again. So there seems to be a lot of ambiguity here. I think looking at the Genji passage and at some other passages, it seems that people understood that the ideal was that once you became a shuke, you really were giving up lay life, and you really were becoming a celibate renunciant. However, on the level of practice, it seems that that ideal was often ignored or just not put into practice, I suppose. And thank you for your question. I see Bhikkhu Analayo has asked that for that period of time they would need to be celibate. Yes. So the idea from what we're able to gather is that certainly during the period when they are actually marked as shuke, they would be celibate. There may be some exceptions, though. There's the case of a nun named Abutsuni, and actually Christina Laffin at the University of British Columbia has written a book on Abutsuni. So the nun Abutsuni lived in the 13th century. She was quite an ambitious writer and a great poet who had some of her poems published, or some of her poems got into anthologies, so it's sort of similar to being published at the time. So she was able to compete, really, with the literary men of her time in a way that very few women were able to do. But she spent a period of her life as a shuke. In fact, there seemed to be several times during her life when she took vows, and so she's known as the nun Abutsu. So the ni on Abutsu ni means nun. So she has this name Abutsu ni, or the nun Abutsu. But the historical records seem to suggest, from what we can gather, that she took vows and actually went to live at Hokkeji, the nunnery that I studied in my book. And that during her time at Hokkeji, she worked as a teacher, as an educator, probably of women, but maybe of others as well, teaching the tale of Genji, among other things. And she seems to have met her next husband or her husband through some of those connections at Hokkeji. And so she actually had become a nun, was living at Hokkeji, and then she meets her husband during that period and goes back to an ordinary lay life. She leaves that period of nunhood behind and gets married, lives a life with him, has some children, and then later on, probably when she's closer to retirement age and is thinking about preparation for death, then she becomes a nun again. So there are some examples like that which suggest that becoming a nun, even though in these literary examples, it seems like a drastic, irreversible act, that there are these historical examples that suggest that, in fact, it wasn't necessarily a reversible act. And so now I'm looking at another question from Nianika Shamaneri, and I'm sorry if I'm getting pronunciations terribly wrong. So you say, you noted as a characteristic of the lay nun a commitment to full-time religious practice. Even in the paper, some managed to become pregnant or to become otherwise entwined in social circumstances that led them to dropping the renunciation and becoming active wives. Absolutely. Without seeming to gather social censure. How did this looseness within renunciation during this earlier period impact the holding of precepts and the reemergence of ordination in the 13th century? That's a great question. So I guess one point to make is that this kind of looseness with regard to the precepts, it's not just looseness with regard to the precepts that we see among women. We really see something very parallel with men in the precepts during this period. So As I'm sure many of you have heard, the way that the precepts are handled in Japan is quite different. We see the rise of the Bodhisattva precepts in early Japan, really, with Saicho. We see the rise of the Bodhisattva precepts really as something that came to replace for many the Vinaya precepts. And so there was always, I guess, going back to Saicho at least, a certain amount of looseness surrounding the precepts. What we see with the reemergence of nuns' orders in the 13th century is that this comes as part of a broader initiative to revive the precepts in Japan as a whole. And so, and I talk about this in the book, but there's a priest named Eison, who was born in 1201, and he was affiliated with the Ritsu or Vinaya sect in Japan, which was interested in reviving the Vinaya precepts, because by his time, the Bodhisattva precepts had become really the norm for ordination in Japan. And so there were very few monks, especially if you hear him tell it in his own journals and writing, he laments the fact that in Japan, people aren't carrying out, monastics are not carrying out the precepts. They're not getting together for regular, they're not getting together to recite the precepts to each other and so on. They're not carrying out the various rituals that are mentioned in the Vinaya, and they're not taking the full sets of precepts. Except for, and if there were a few lineages here and there that were still using the full precepts, but probably not carrying out all of the related rituals. And so for Eison, one of his main goals really was to revive the practice of the Vinaya, the practice of the precepts in Japan. And it's really as a part of that larger project to revive the precepts in Japan, to revive the Vinaya, that he becomes interested in recreating monastic platforms or ordination platforms for bhikkhuni in Japan. And so that kind of, let's see, you said, how does that looseness within renunciation impact the holding of precepts in the reemergence in the 13th century? So I think what we see in the 13th century is really a reaction against what had been perceived as this long-standing looseness with regard to the precepts, that people felt that it was important to kind of get back to this more authentic or truer form of Buddhism that was closer to that which Shakyamuni practiced and so on. And so, yeah, I think we can think of this really as a kind of reaction against that perceived looseness or perhaps real looseness with regard to the precepts. Now, that's not to say that this shuke form of renunciation didn't endure. It absolutely endured. And so even after we see the reemergence of bhikkhuni platforms, ordination platforms in Japan, that's alongside this shuke practice, which continues. And so if you read medieval Japanese literature, I mean, really, Heian period, Kamakura period and the Muromachi period, which is going further into the medieval period of Japan, you read literature from those eras, you will see a lot of references to the nun so-and-so or the monk so-and-so. And very often those are ordinary lay people who have decided to style themselves as shuke. And so probably they've taken, and I outline this in the article, sort of what the steps would be, but in most cases that means that they have probably gotten some master to give them precepts, although there was probably absolutely cases in which people didn't have the opportunity to get precepts from an actual master and maybe just styled themselves as a monk or nun without taking precepts. That's a little bit harder to know, but I think there's kind of a general understanding that that probably happened. There were also practices in which people might take precepts from a Buddhist image. And in fact, that's something that even Eison recommended. and people would could shave their heads themselves. In the case of women, we see women cutting the hair in stages, and that's something I talk about in the article. Let's see, I think I have a couple of images of that here. So we have in Japan during this period a number of different terms to refer to women who were what we might call partially tonsured. So there's this term sage ama or sogi ama, ama sogi. These are basically partially tonsured nuns. And this is a really interesting phenomenon. There's a Japanese scholar named Katsura Noriko who's done some really interesting work in which she is able to identify places in certain Chinese texts that identify nuns who have, that is, lay women who have cut their hair, usually to the shoulders. I mean, usually sage ama refers to hair that's been cut to the shoulders, although there are some images that suggest that this could refer to hair that's cut about chin length. Katsura says that there are some Chinese sources, or at least one, that links this practice of cutting the hair partially to the Shiki Shamana stage, this kind of intermediary stage between a novice nun and a full-fledged bhikkhuni. And so, of course, we know that in the Indian context, this was a two-year stage, which we think was meant to make sure that no woman who may have entered pregnant would actually be able to advance to the bhikkhuni stage having had a child. There's very little evidence that in Japan this sage ama stage was connected with Shiki Shamana. That is, and I explain this in the article, but basically that's because we don't see a lot of evidence that sage ama were on some kind of time schedule to get to bhikkhuni status. Many women would have remained sage ama for years and years. And so we don't know that that they were necessarily connected in Japan, but there may be a historical connection. So it could be that in China that connection had been made, and then that practice of cutting the hair partially made it to Japan, but was interpreted a little bit differently and not seen necessarily as part of this Shiki Shamana stage. What made this important in Japan was that for elite women of the court, their hair was everything. So these women had hair that would go down to the floor and really exceed the length of their bodies. And so that was, a beautiful woman was to have this exceedingly long hair that would extend down to the floor. And I'm just showing you a couple of images here in which we see women with this very, very long hair. This extremely long hair was a marker of a beautiful woman, a woman who is sexually available. And so cutting the hair symbolized a kind of step towards sexual renunciation, a step even towards death, if you think about shuke as a period in life in which one is preparing for death. What I argue in this article is that the sage ama stage allows for this kind of fluid status that could enable women to return to lay life if really necessary. So, and I do talk about a few examples in the article of women who may have become sage ama. So they may have done this as a shuke, taken some vows, but instead of shaving the head, just cutting their hair, probably to the shoulders. If they decided to go back to lay life, they still wouldn't be considered as beautiful or as desirable as they had been with their extremely long tresses, and it would take years and years to grow the hair out to that length again. However, this would have prevented them from giving up that ability to marry again or to have romantic entanglements again. Shaving the head in this particular historical and cultural context may have made it extremely difficult for women to go back to a life of courtship and of romantic entanglements. I'm not sure that that's completely true, because there are excerpts in literature from this period where men talk about how cute it is, or how childlike a woman looks with hair cut to chin length, perhaps. So there may have been some men who did find that attractive. Maybe women weren't fully giving up, wouldn't have been fully giving everything up if they had shaved their heads, because they could have grown their hair back out to chin length at least within a few years, I suppose. But that's kind of one way of thinking about the Sage-ama stage, is that it allows for a kind of fluid status that is somewhat reversible. That if a woman decides that she does, like the nun Abutsu, want to go back to a married life or to a life of romantic engagement, that is possible from the Sage-ama stage. Becoming a bhikkhuni was not so common among shuke, and so that's one reason for thinking that women who became shuke and cut their hair partially probably didn't see that as something that would lead to becoming a bhikkhuni in just a couple of years. It seems to be the case that, I mean, first of all, real bhikkhuni ordination wasn't available during this time. If we're talking about the Heian period, anything previous to the reestablishment of the ordinations at Hokkeji in the mid-1200s, full-fledged bhikkhuni ordination wasn't really available. However, women did commonly take something akin to bhikkhuni ordination on their deathbeds. That is, they would shave the head completely and take a more complete set of precepts. So becoming a bhikkhuni and shaving the head completely was probably associated with deathbed practice during this time. And there's quite a bit of evidence that I talk about in the article that some women, many women in fact, may have believed that by shaving the head on the deathbed, one could die as a monk, and specifically as a male monk. And there's a Japanese scholar named Mitsuhashi Tadashi who has made this argument, and I think it's a very compelling argument. He has quite a bit of evidence. But basically, he makes the argument that people wanted to die in the form of a Buddhist monk, with the idea that would create vast merit for the next life, but that for women in particular, it would actually allow them to die as men, and therefore to be able to, I guess, probably gain birth as a man in the next life. So I want to show you just a couple of images. This is an image of a Sage-ama or Sogi-ama, a partially tonsured nun. This is probably from a slightly later period when it became more common, we think, for women to cut the hair to the chin length rather than the shoulder length. So this does seem to have been something that changed with time. And generally in the earlier periods, we see Sage-ama with longer hair cut around the shoulders. And then in later periods, as we get into Muromachi and so on, late medieval, this even shorter hairstyle seems to have become common. We also see a lot of shuke, or these lay nuns, with these head coverings. And I talk about that a little bit in the article. They do come to be associated with women, although these head coverings are coverings that male monks sometimes wore as well. And this is an image in which we see women of various hairstyles. This woman probably had taken full tonsure. We can't see any hair peeking out of her head covering here. And this woman here seems to have cut her hair partially. This seems to be the end of her hair right here, I believe. And this woman here, too, has cut her hair partially. It also seems to have been common for, in some cases, for women to kind of do a token cut of the hair where maybe only the, I think I've seen this in some images, maybe only a couple of pieces from the front were really cut short, rather than all of the hair. And this is another image of several nuns in front of an image of Amitabha, undoubtedly doing some Pure Land practice. And you can see that the women whose heads are not covered seem to be Sage Amma. This woman has still very long hair, but the front part of her hair is cut shorter. And then this woman here, again, she has in the front there these short pieces. That seems to be a Sage Amma style. And these are just examples of women wearing the head covering. Lay nuns wearing these head coverings. This woman may have shaved her head completely. It's a bit hard to tell. And this is an example of a woman with a full head of hair. So I'm going to come back to this image later. This is the image I wanted to get to. So this is an image of a woman on her deathbed. And I wanted to say just a little bit about this. So this is from the Honen Shonin Eden. It is an illustrated biography of the Pure Land priest, Honen. So Honen, of course, was a Tendai priest who popularized an easier form of Nembutsu practice, a much easier form than what Genshin had popularized. And so this is an early 14th century illustrated biography of Honen. And what we see here is a woman who is on her deathbed. And it's actually this woman on the right here, to the right of this image of Amitabha. So this is an example of a deathbed practice in which Amitabha is, an image of Amitabha is placed in front of the person who's passing away. And here is a priest accompanying the dying person, probably helping her chant Nembutsu and so on. We can see she has some prayer beads in her hands there. She's dressed like a full monk here. She has her ketsa and her robes. Her head has been completely shaven. And really, from the way this woman is depicted here, she seems very androgynous. It's difficult to tell her sex, whether she's male or female. And I think this is a kind of a nice illustration of Mitsuhashi's idea that women may have wanted to die kind of looking like men, looking like a male monastic, with the idea that this would enable them to die as men. And of course, we know that there was this idea, which again, I'll talk about in a little while, that it was what, that it, that women should seek rebirth into male bodies in order to advance on the Buddhist path. And so this is as a way where we see that idea come into practice, that in dying as a man, one could work towards that goal of rebirth in a male body. This image, I think, also hits upon some of the other points that I talk about in the article, which is that when becoming a lay renunciant, a shuke, women sort of gradually shed markers of their femininity. So certainly there was this idea that they were cutting off romantic ties, but also the outward markers of femininity that were important at this time, like the long hair they're getting rid of. They're taking on Buddhist names, ordination names that usually were very androgynous. It was very difficult, typically, to tell the sex of a Buddhist monastic in this period of Japan based solely on ordination name, because the ordination names were so similar and typically didn't signify gender at all. And in fact, there is some evidence that when women use their ordination names, they could sign particular legal documents and so on that were ordinarily difficult for women to sign. So there might have been a certain kind of freedom that came with becoming a shuke, because one could kind of let go of some of the limitations of being a woman in this particular society, in this particular time. And then we also see, of course, that the Buddhist robes are androgynous. Men and women wear the same robes. So in becoming a shuke, one thing that I argue in the article is that women are kind of slowly or gradually shedding their identity as women. And certainly in these deathbed scenes where women are trying to die as men, that notion comes through, I think, very strongly. And then I wanted to show you this slide that I skipped over a second ago. These are really interesting. This is what's called an ekezu. It's an illustrated genealogy, or I guess that's the best word, an illustrated lineage chart from a Jodo Shinshu, a true Pure Land school or temple. And this is from the Muromachi period, from the later medieval period. But so this doesn't kind of directly relate to what I've been talking about, but it, I think, underscores this idea that for women, becoming a nun at this time in Japan represented a kind of shedding of feminine identity or female identity. And what these are is, these are lineage charts that shows membership in Jodo-shin communities. And what was so interesting is that families would join temples together, basically. And so instead of, typically in a lineage, it's a disciple to student to student and so on type of lineage that includes all monastics who are celibate and don't have families. But the Jodo-shin school would actually bring in, put families into these lineage charts, because it was a very kind of family-oriented school. And so what we have in these lineage charts are men at the top and their wives and children underneath. And so these three individuals on the top here are men who are lay renunciants, but they're portrayed as full-fledged monks. And then beneath them, their wives. And I think typically we have a given person's wife right underneath him. And then we even have some children and information about their ages and their names and so on is given. But what the point I wanted to make with this basically is that it's difficult to tell the sex of these individuals based on the ordination names alone. So here what are given are ordination names. And that even with the clothing is basically the same. The robes are the same. And so it's only really in the way faces are depicted. So if women are given softer features, if they're made, their bodies are portrayed as smaller. It's sort of these very subtle markers that allow one to know or identify these as women instead of men. And of course, one of the conventions of this type of illustration is that the men were put on top and the women underneath. And so then we know, well, these are the men because they're on the top layer here and their wives are underneath. But the markers of female versus male identity are very, very subtle. And so I think this is another illustration that helps us really visualize how women were giving up markers of feminine identity by becoming shuke. There was one convention in which women were often portrayed with much lighter skin, and you can kind of see that here with this nun. She's portrayed with very, very light skin. That sets her apart a bit from some of the other images here. That's one way that artists sometimes would identify women versus men. But the markers, I think, are pretty subtle. So from there, let's see, I wanted to just mention a couple of other examples of what it meant for people to become shuke during this period. So some of the slides that I skipped over here, these are just examples of individuals from works of this period. So this is from Eiga Monogatari, or A Tale of Flowering Fortunes, an example of Fujiwara no Kinto, a great courtier, who becomes a shuke by inviting a very high-ranking priest, actually, to his quarters, and asks him to perform a precept ceremony for him. So I think I've already talked quite a bit about this. I won't go into more detail here. But these kinds of examples are very common. One of the interesting things about this example is that we see the reaction of his family when he does this. So he kind of secretly calls a priest into his quarters to give him the precepts and to shave his head. And then when his family finds out, first his son-in-law rushes over to his residence, Nagatani, to pour out his disappointment. So he's extremely disappointed that his father-in-law would do this. And his wife and daughter also fall into the depths of despair, we're told. And there are really two reasons why his family might react this way. One, of course, is that they feel somewhat betrayed that he would decide to leave his family obligations behind and become a shuke. Now, he probably will continue to reside at his own home. This becoming a shuke probably does not mean that he's actually going to go live in a monastery. But there is this expectation that he won't be as engaged in family life. He'll be turning himself over to Buddhist devotions. And so then his wife and daughter falling into despair, this may be for similar reasons. Dad's not going to be spending as much time with us. His wife may feel betrayed in that, oh, he's cutting off our conjugal relationship. But then there's also this sense that if he's doing this, he must feel that the end is near. He's already thinking about death, and so that implicitly is very sad, and so on. And then again, this is yet another example of an aristocrat taking shuke in similar circumstances. And then there was one other thing I wanted to mention regarding becoming a shuke during this period. And that is that even though it was seen as something that could be very sad because one's preparing for death, there was also this idea that at a certain age, this was the right thing to do. And that if you were 70 years old, and, you know, think about the life expectancy during this period in history, if you're 60 or 70 years old and you're not a shuke, it means that you haven't really grasped the reality that the end is near, that you're, in a sense, being kind of irresponsible, or you're living in a fantasy world. You're not taking your Buddhist obligations seriously if, at an older age, you're still out there living an ordinary lay life and not focused on the next life. And that, again, is because we have this notion with Genshin and Pure Land Buddhism at this time that preparation for death was a really serious enterprise and really did require one to devote a huge amount of time to preparing for death, and to do that while being a layperson engaged in political affairs and family entanglements and so on, wasn't really possible. One really needed to devote oneself to devotions. And so these are a couple of examples also from literature of the period in which people are kind of derided or spoken, but dismissed in a sense, because they're not shuke at an age when they really should be shuke. So one example is from the Shin Saru Gakuki, And this is a woman who had married a much younger man. So she had married a man who was 20 years her junior. It was advantageous for him, I think, because she was wealthy. And she, at the age of 60, is extremely wrinkled and in bad physical condition. But instead of becoming a nun, a shukke, she is going to shrines, trying to perform fertility rituals and putting on all kinds of cosmetics and wearing clothing to try to entice her husband and so on. She really wants the sexual attention of her husband. And the narrator basically makes fun of her. He says, even though she should, of course, have shaven off her snow-white hair and become a nun without delay, she remained attached to this vain life. So she's seen as this ridiculous character because at the age of 60, she's trying to remain engaged in sexual activity instead of becoming a nun. And then we have this other excerpt from Ega Monogatari, which is one that I've been pulling a lot of excerpts from. And this is a comment about a man who keeps talking about how he wants to become a shuke. And again, this is something we see a lot in literature of this period, people saying that they're longing to become a renunciant. But he doesn't actually go through with it. And so they are saying that this is, that he's kind of a silly old fool for not realizing that he really should be a shuke by now. So it says, Akimitsu talked all day long about his plans for the future. I often think of becoming a monk, he would say, but my chief desire is to see these children settled in life. And that's a very common statement for aristocrats to make. They need to make sure their kids are married properly and so on. The monks staying in the mansion for the ritual seclusion must have chuckled to one another in private. So it's very common for aristocrats to call monks in to perform various rituals at their residences. So these are the monks who were staying in his mansion for a ritual. They must have laughed, chuckled to each other in private, not because there was anything laughable about the children, but because it was ridiculous for a dotard in his 70s to be planning for the remote future instead of reciting the name of Amitabha. So Akimitsu should have become a shuke and should be reciting the name of Amitabha by now. And then here, this is just listing some of the different types of precepts that shuke would take. And this was often, there were many different possibilities. It could be the 5 lay precepts or the 10 novice precepts of the 4-part Vinaya or the 10 major bodhisattva precepts of the Brahmanet Sutra or the Fanlong Jing. And there, we do have many texts that outline actual shuke ceremonies, so precept ordination ceremonies for these lay renunciants. And some of them are quite lavish, quite extensive. I've written a little bit about these. I have an article that I wrote about shuke records of elite women, mostly royal and aristocratic women. And often they would have shuke ceremonies performed that were quite lavish and elaborate, and then record these. And those records of their shuke ceremonies would be used as precedents or examples for women later on down the line who would be having similar ceremonies performed. So they might look back at previous records to see how certain aspects of the ceremony were performed. So now that I've kind of laid out what being a shuke meant, in the article I do talk about how shuke marked more of a change in sexual identity for women than for men. For men, they're men before the shuke, they're men after the shuke. There's certainly this idea that they're giving up conjugal relationships, but they're not shedding their sexual identity as such. For women, we really do see this kind of gradual shedding of femininity, loss of hair, the taking of an ambiguous name, and so on. Let's see. And then this is yet another example of a woman, the Sarashina Niki is again, a Heian period text. And this is an passage in which the author talks about her mother becoming a nun and that she stayed at home. She stayed in the same estate, but just lived separately in a kind of her own practice hall. And then the father took over more household activities because the mother had really taken herself out of away from those obligations, withdrawn from those obligations. And here we see this as effectively a kind of it's a kind of divorce because the father is left without his wife as a lover anymore, and she's no longer living in the main household, but they still have a relationship of sorts. They still have a kind of friendly relationship. And we see that in many other examples from literature of the period of couples ending their sexual relationship, but remaining kind of friends and still talking about their children and still maybe consulting about minor household things. But allowing each other, and especially the one who has taken vows, to really focus on Buddhist devotions. Okay, so I'm sorry I kind of went out of order on some of those slides. I would like to now say a little bit about how this practice changes a bit in the Kamakura period. So the Kamakura period is marked as, or seen really as a time when the warrior government is established in Japan, and we see a general shift. It doesn't happen right in 1185, but we see this kind of general shift from a court-based society to a warrior-based society. So eventually during the Kamakura period, warriors are able to take control over governance away from the courtly establishment. Again, this happens gradually, and it's really the 13th century before the warrior government becomes extremely strong. But we see a lot of social changes that come with this move to a warrior-based government. The capital for that warrior government is Kamakura in the east. So we have the old court government that's based in Kyoto in the west, and then we have the new warrior government that's established in Kamakura in the east. What eventually, and this is, I'm making a lot of generalizations here, it's a little more subtle, the argumentation in the article, but generally what we see is that warrior society comes to emphasize patriarchal laws quite forcefully eventually, and also to really emphasize Confucian values and the notion of household loyalty. The styles of marriage also change a bit during this period. In the Han period, we have a very common form of marriage is called wife visiting, in which women would stay with their own birth families and be visited by their husbands. The difficult part of this for some women was that those men may be visiting a lot of different wives. But the advantage for women was that they could stay with their natal families, inherit property from their natal families, and so on. So there was a kind of stability that offered. What we eventually see is the adoption of patrilocal practices in which women would go to live with the husband's family, would have fewer inheritance rights. And what happens, I talk about this in the article, is that the warrior government becomes increasingly concerned with passing on property that includes a kind of military duty. So there were certain estates that could be passed down that had attached to them military obligations. And there were many times when those properties were handed down to women, and it was just assumed that a woman would find a male relative to go out and complete the military service, that somehow she would fill that. But with the Mongol invasions near the end of the 13th century and various military concerns surrounding the Mongol invasions, there was more and more anxiety over the possibility that a woman might inherit an estate that had a military obligation attached to it and not fulfill that military obligation. And so the warrior government starts to crack down on bequeathals of property to women. It becomes much more difficult for women to inherit property. And we also see the rise of a lot of really Confucian values or ideologies surrounding household loyalty, loyalty in general. So probably many of you are familiar with the idea of loyalty to one samurai lord and so on in much literature from medieval Japan. There's a lot of scholarship on that topic and on how, you know, the idea of being loyal to your samurai master is really extolled in so much medieval literature. But in practice, of course, a lot of samurai were not at all so loyal to their masters and so on. But what's interesting is that same kind of logic of loyalty to one's master or to one's household comes up in medieval literature with regard to women. And so what eventually happens, and I'm going to make this kind of short here for the sake of time because I want to talk about a few other things before we end, but what eventually happens is that becoming a nun comes to be associated or understood as a way for women to show loyalty to her husband's line. This is very different from what we see in the Heian and early Kamakura, or it's very different, I'm sorry, from what we see in the Heian text. In Kamakura period text, it becomes more and more common. But basically, we come to see these anecdotes in which it's suggested that when a woman's husband dies, to be loyal to his household, she should become a nun because that indicates that she's not going to remarry. She's not going to join another family or another household. And so nunhood as a marker of loyalty comes to be really praised in medieval literature. And it's that image of the widow nun that really has this kind of staying power in Japanese culture, so that a lot of contemporary scholars of Buddhism and just members of the populace who like history have this image of Japanese Buddhist nuns as being these oppressed widows. That is, women who, because they were widowed, were forced to become nuns. And so there's this kind of very dark image of nunhood in pre-modern Japan among a lot of scholars in Japan and among just a lot of history buffs in Japan, because that's the image that became so popular in a lot of medieval literature. So there's this idea that women were forced to become nuns as a way of showing that they weren't going to remarry. But what I really tried to do in this article is to show that that's a historical development. If we look at what shuke were, what female shuke were in the Heian period, it was a very different thing. These were women who, like the men in their lives, wanted to prepare for death, wanted time to set aside to carry out their Buddhist devotions and so on. They weren't forced to become nuns. We have all these examples, like many that I've shown you today, in which women became nuns while their husbands were living because this was something that they were committed to. And it's only much later that we see this idea that, first of all, widows should remain chaste and should not remarry, but then that by becoming nuns, they can show society that they're not remarrying. They can show society that they are true to their husband's line and so on. So in the article, I just show various examples from literature of this kind of shift towards the widow nun, the image of the widow nun. One of the I guess, important things to know historically about why women may have become nuns when they were widowed, especially in the late Kamakura period. It's because the warrior government made a rule in a legal code called the... let's see, I will tell you what page this is on in the article. So it's on page 53 near the end of the article. That there's a 1232 legal code called the Gosei by Shikimoku. And this was a legal code issued by the warrior government. And basically they said that if a woman is divorced by her husband, and it's his decision, she gets to keep any property that he may have given her during the marriage. However, if she leaves the marriage and marries someone else, or if she's widowed and marries someone else, she cannot carry any property she received from her husband into that new marriage. So there was this concern about women transferring the property of one man into another man's household. And so what happened is that by becoming widows, women could show that they were remaining true to their husband's line, and they could hold on to property. So becoming a widow nun was actually a way of holding on to property. And there's been some research done. Kitomi Tonomura at the University of Michigan has written about how there are legal cases that show that some women took on the outward appearance of nuns to maintain control over property once they were widowed, but actually carried on romantic affairs. So they may have had a boyfriend or a serious relationship, but portrayed them or styled themselves as a nun so they could maintain control of their property. So there were things like that that happened. But there is this very strong image that comes through in a lot of Kamakura literature of women being so loyal to their husbands that they become nuns. And in fact, and I've written about this other places, there seems to be this continuum between becoming a nun on the one hand and committing suicide, following one's husband in death on the other hand. That seems to have been extremely rare. There were these kind of widow martyr cults in China that I've read about extensively, where you know some women were kind of pressured by families to make this huge show of devotion to their husband when widowed by actually committing suicide. That shows up as an ideal in Japanese literature. In a lot of warrior literature from the medieval period, women following their husbands in death, often by drowning themselves. I think it was mostly a literary ideal and probably not practiced much during this early period. There's some evidence that it may have been practiced in later periods, especially in the early modern period. But what's interesting is that in a lot of the literature, there's this kind of parallel set up. So this idea that becoming a nun is a kind of social death, perhaps, that's not as extreme as committing suicide, but it still shows this kind of great devotion, especially if a young woman does it. If a young woman who hasn't had children, hasn't been married long, becomes a nun following her husband's death, then that's seen as a very powerful statement of her loyalty. So I think I'm probably running out of time here, but I will just say a few more things, if that's okay. Okay, thank you. So I just got word that it's okay for me to talk a little bit longer. One of the examples, so these slides here, here I'm just mentioning that by the mid-Kamakura period, so as we're getting more into the period of warrior rule, we see that a lot of women were taking shuke vows only after their husbands passed away. Whereas in the Han period, as I had shown, there were many cases where women did this before their husbands had passed away. And then eventually we see it as almost an expectation of something a woman should do after her husband passes away. There's a kind of fun story that I mentioned in the article from a collection called Zou Danshu from the early 14th century of a woman, the wife of Fujiwara no Kagetomo, who takes vows. Her husband is going on a journey to China with his lord, and she wants to show her loyalty to him, so she doesn't know if he'll return, right, because it was very dangerous to travel by sea at this time. So she shows her loyalty to him by cutting off a lock of her hair and throwing it into the ship. And that is also becomes a very common trope during this period, that a woman who wants to show her lover how devoted she is to him, she can cut off a lock of her hair, meaning that if something happens, I will become a nun. I won't marry someone else, basically. So she does this. Something happens. There's a shipwreck. He never returns. She thinks he has died. She becomes a shuke, styles herself as a nun. And it turns out that his master dies, but he remains alive. And so he follows the same model of loyalty and devotes himself to praying for the soul of his soul seems like the wrong thing to say in a Buddhist context, but praying for the rebirth of his master. Kagetomo also becomes a monk and devotes himself to Buddhist devotions for his master, just as his wife, unknowing, like, who doesn't know that he's still alive, is carrying out prayers for her husband, whom she thinks is dead. So the two of them end up living near each other, it turns out. One is a monk, the other is a nun. And then one day on a pilgrimage to a temple, they run into each other and start a conversation and realize that they are long-lost lovers, that she, out of great devotion to her husband, has become a nun, and he, out of great devotion to his master, had become a monk. And so then they are reunited, but not as lovers, rather as kind of friends in the Dharma. So this is a fun story that sort of shows how those who are committed to this sense of household loyalty or loyalty to one's master are rewarded for that kind of loyalty. They're both shown as paragons of loyalty. This excerpt is just from, this is from a wonderful work called Towazugatari, or The Confessions of Lady Nijo. This is a woman from late medieval, I guess it's more mid-medieval Japan, who had served in court during her youth, and then as an older woman, she falls out of favor with her master, the retired sovereign Gofukakusa, and becomes an itinerant nun. So she becomes a shuke who travels around on foot on lots and lots of pilgrimages. And she had been told by her father that if she had ever fallen out of favor with her master, the retired sovereign Gofukakusa. So he's sort of like a husband, but he's really a master because he has other lovers and so on. And she's seen as a member of his household. But her father said, if you ever fall out of favor with him, you should immediately enter the true way. So he means you should become a nun. That will enable you to work for your own salvation, to repay your debts to your parents, and to pray that we will be reunited in paradise, that is, she and her father. He says, becoming a nun is the thing that you should do. What you should not do is to serve another master or try to make your way by entering another household whatsoever. So you should not become another man's wife. Or this seems to suggest even become a member of another household as a servant and so on. This would be very shameful to him. So we see already in this 13th century example, this ideal of household loyalty, that it's much better to become a nun and show your loyalty that way your devotion to one household than to join a new household. And this is very different from what we would have seen in the Heian period, when joining another household wouldn't have been such a big deal. And in fact, in the article, I talk about how there are some examples from Heian period literature in which a woman, upon becoming a widow, says, "I'm going to become a nun." And instead of people praising her as they would in this later period, people think that this is so sad and tragic that a young woman would become a nun instead of joining another household. So these ideas about what widows should do really do change from the Heian period into the especially late Kamakura period. Becoming a nun as a show of loyalty, even if you're relatively young, becomes the norm, or at least the ideal, if not the norm in practice. And there was a question, were itinerant nuns alms mendicants or self-supported? That's a great question. So alms rounds never really became as common in Japan as they were in Southeast Asia. Of course, there were people who practiced going on alms rounds, but not in the same way as what you would see in Theravadan communities. And I think this is probably part of what happens when Buddhism comes through East Asia, is that there was, I guess, this Confucian reaction to alms rounds that was very negative, and a lot of emphasis on how monastics should be able to support themselves. What we see with the case of Lady Nijo, for example, is that when she's traveling around as an itinerant nun, she's not going on alms begging rounds, but she does kind of find little jobs here and there. So she has this great knowledge of the court, having served the retired sovereign for so long. So when she travels, sometimes people will consult her about things like how to sew a kimono properly, or what types of rules, protocols should be followed in a certain ceremony and so on. So she has certain kinds of knowledge because she is this very well-educated woman that enables her to take on kind of little jobs where she was probably given some kind of remuneration. So she does rely on the kindness of others, really, when she's traveling, but it's not begging as such. It's not alms rounds as such. So the other question is, being a nun seemed to require financial support from one's family. With no state positions for women renunciates during this period, were there places that accepted renunciant women who were not privately funded? That's a good question. So I think that's a hard question to get at from the documents that we have. I know in the case of Hokkeji, it's not clear what women brought into the nunnery. It seems that some may have brought private wealth with them. But I think there may have been cases where women entered the nunnery without a lot of financial means. With itinerant nuns, I think that there were women who would take on kind of odd jobs, or they might become guides at pilgrimage sites and so on. They might do a little teaching, for example, for some alms. I think that there is some evidence that they may have done laundry for monks, for example, and received some financial payments that way. But this is a good question. I think we don't know enough about how women supported themselves as nuns during this period. The nuns at Hokkeji did have donors, and so one thing that they could do was to attract pilgrims to. I mean, that took a certain kind of capital up front, but once women had control of a temple that attracted pilgrims, they say if they had an image that was considered miraculous and pilgrims came to see that image, this was a way that they could earn money, basically, was to attract pilgrims and donations. And then they also performed various rituals and would receive money for that, so or at least donations. So I hope that kind of answers your question. The itinerant nuns is a trickier question, and I think there were cases where women were met with very difficult circumstances if they were itinerant nuns and couldn't find ways to support themselves. But I think probably guiding people around pilgrimage sites and doing some teaching, there were little things like that that they could do for donations, small donations. Thank you. So I'll end here with just an episode from the Heike Monogatari, which is probably the greatest military or war epic of Japan. And this is about the Genpei War, which is seen as what ushered in the era of warrior rule in Japan. So there's this fascinating episode in Heike Monogatari where a woman named Kozaisho commits suicide when she hears that her husband, Taira no Michimori, had died in battle. So here's a place where we see very strong Confucian ideas about household loyalty come in. So the narrator says about Kozaisho's committing suicide, among the many women who have lost husbands, it has long been common practice to enter the religious life, to become shuke. But few have gone so far as to drown themselves. So she had drowned herself. Might this be the kind of thing that is meant by the saying, a loyal retainer does not obey two lords, a chaste woman does not serve two husbands? So this is an excerpt from the Chinese classics talking about basically praising her for being willing to commit suicide, to follow her husband in death. This is from the classic Shurji. So what's really interesting about this episode is that right before Kozaisho commits suicide, her nurse tries to talk her out of it. And this is what her nurse says. Her nurse says, take holy vows somewhere, even among the rocks and the trees. So that is, even if you don't have a master to bestow the precepts on you, just go give yourself holy vows. And recite Buddha invocations for Michimori, that is her deceased husband's enlightenment. You may think you are sure to go to the same place as he does, but who knows which of the six paths and the four births will be your lot after you enter the next life. It would be pointless to drown yourself when the chances of reunion are so uncertain. So the argument I make in the article is that I feel like this quotation here really illustrates this kind of turning point where we see two different paradigms of the afterlife. And a preparation for death kind of juxtaposed with each other. So Kozaisho's maid, who's a little bit older, seems to subscribe to the older view that we see in works like Genshin, that birth in the Pure Land is really difficult. There's no guarantee that you're going to be born into the Pure Land. This is something that requires a lot of practice. You should devote yourself to years of practice to make sure that you die in just the right way so that you will, in fact, be born in the Pure Land. She says, you may think that if you commit suicide, you're going to end up in the same place reunited with your husband in the Pure Land, but how do you know that that's where you're going to be born? You need to become a nun and really devote yourself to proper practice to make sure that you are mentally prepared and spiritually prepared for the moment of death. But Kozaisho herself seems to be subscribing to this newer model, which we see with the teachings of Honen and later Pure Land thinkers, that in fact, being born in the Pure Land is really easy. You don't have to devote yourself to years and years of practice. You can just say the Nembutsu. You can just say Namu Amida Butsu. With the teachings of Shinran, you can just say it once with the mind of true faith, and that's all it takes to be born into the Pure Land. Kozaisho seems to be subscribing to that view, that being born in the Pure Land is actually very easy. And I think she seems to even feel that this act of being so devoted to your household or to your husband, this act of committing suicide or giving up your life, following someone in death, is also really meritorious, and that that merit will also help her get to the Pure Land. And so this is a view that really contrasts with the older Heian views of how one is able to seek a good birth. So she seems to feel that by jumping into the sea and following her husband in death, that's going to get her the merit she needs to be reunited with her husband in the Pure Land. And in fact, she ignores her nurse's advice and she does commit suicide. And there are a lot of examples from this period. It comes up in the tale of Genji too, of lovers talking about wanting to be reunited in the Pure Land, that we can be reunited in the Pure Land just by saying the Nembutsu and so on. There's also in the letters of Shinran's wife, Eshin-ni, who had styled herself as a nun too. She has that ni on the end of her name, so she's the nun Eshin, the wife of Shinran, this great Tendai monk who became the founder of the Jodo Shin school and was the first to kind of openly marry as a monk in Japan. He and his wife, in a letter to their daughter, talks about saying the Nembutsu so they can be reunited in the Pure Land. So there seems to have been this literary trope of people kind of consciously wanting to be reunited in the Pure Land. And this seems to be an idea that Kozaisho is subscribing to when she follows her husband in death. That's really what I wanted to talk about in this presentation, was how these ideas about what it means to be a female lay renunciant change over time, and how it starts out as something that seems to really be about preparing for death, a decision that a woman might make independently, to something that signals household loyalty and that symbolizes a very devoted wife who becomes a nun after her husband dies to show that she would never consider entering another household or taking on another husband. I thought that I was going to have a bunch of extra time, so I had included some additional slides to talk about some of these androcentric terms that come up in Buddhist rhetoric. I don't know if I'm okay with talking for a few more minutes if it's acceptable. Okay, I'll talk about this a little bit then. Thank you for the green light. So this is kind of a separate topic, but it's related. Often when people talk about Buddhism and women in Japan, first we have, you know, what I've just talked about, that is this trope of the poor oppressed widow nun who's forced into nunhood because her husband has died and society expects her to become a nun. So that's sort of one negative image that I hope I've been able to show is actually much more complicated than has been suggested. But another kind of complicated set of concepts that also have very negative connotations are these concepts about how difficult it is for a woman to succeed on the Buddhist path. So this is less about practice and nunhood, but more about these so-called obstacles or hindrances on the Buddhist path that are particular to women. So I won't spend too much time on this, but I just want to sort of tell you a little bit about these various concepts and how we can, I guess, the degree to which we can call them into question by looking at them more carefully. So how widespread were they actually? What did they actually mean to women? So there's kind of three main concepts that we see come up a lot in discussions of women and salvation or women and success on the Buddhist path in Japan. The first is called Gosho, here, or Itsutsu no Sawari is the other way of pronouncing this in Japanese. And this literally means the five obstacles. Sometimes it's translated as the five hindrances. And this is the way that the idea of the five impossibilities for women. So this is something that Bhikkhu Analayo has talked about in a couple of his articles. He sent me two that I really enjoyed. So these, one is the Buddha's past life as a princess, and the other, the Badu Datsuka Sutta and its parallels on women's inabilities. So what he translates as the five impossibilities for women, was translated into these characters in Chinese, and so then in Japanese becomes Gosho or Itsutsu no Sawari. So these are the five positions in the Buddhist cosmos, including that of a Buddha, that a woman cannot attain in a female body. And what's really interesting is that in reading these articles, it was so useful the way Bhikkhu Analayo explained them, because he talks about how these were probably referring, the reason that early Buddhist texts would have seen these positions as impossible for women to attain in a female body was because in Indian society at the time, it would have been sort of unthinkable for a woman to be, say, a Chakravartin, because women simply didn't have those kinds of positions of power and so on. But in Japan, this term comes to take on a lot of different nuances, and it really comes to be seen as a kind of intrinsic deficiency in the female form, that there are these kind of problems or sins associated with the female body, and they prevent women from attaining these five positions. And so this concept, Gosho, is often paired with Sanju, thank you for that comment. That's very interesting. So Sanju is often translated as the three obediences. Sometimes it's called the thrice following. And this idea we can see in the laws of Manu, the idea that a woman follows her father when she is young, her husband when she is middle-aged, and her sons when she is old, that women are always required to follow men. They can't be independent. And so on. So in Japan, these were paired together. So we often see Gosho Sanju as a single four-character compound, seen as something that's a, sort of an intrinsic set of difficulties that come with female bodies. And then related term was Henjo Nanshi, which literally means changing into a male body or changing into a man. So those three terms we see a lot as kind of a triumvirate of problems associated with female bodies and with female salvation. And then there are a lot of kind of related ideas and terms that I've put down below in black ink there. Tenyo Jonan, which is basically the same idea as Henjo Nanshi, that is transforming a woman into a man. Then we have at the very bottom there, Tenyo Jobutsu, transforming a woman into a Buddha, which is a much more positive, way of putting Tenyo Jonan. So not just transforming a woman into a man, but transforming her into a Buddha. And then we have kind of related terms, Nyonin no Shin o Hanare, separating from the female body. And then Nyonin no Shin o Ito. This is kind of like despising the female body. So these terms show up in quite a bit of literature at the time, too. So there's this idea that a woman who wants to attain salvation needs to reject her female body, needs to come to disassociate herself from the female body, reject her female body. We can see that in a positive light as she's rejecting attachment to her female body, just as anyone on the Buddhist path is to reject attachment to the body. But this term ito is pretty strong. It's to kind of despise the female body. So what I have in this chart here, this is actually from a book by the Japanese scholar Nomura Ikuyo. And I'll just discuss this very quickly. So basically, what I found is that we have these, these three big ideas, the Gosho, Sanju, and Henjo Nashi, that people associate so commonly with women's salvation in pre-modern Japan. But if we re-examine what constituted really the dominant discourse on gender and salvation in pre-modern Japan, there are a few things that we can find. First, it seems that lay people of the Heian and Kamakura periods treated a lot of these androcentric ideas as a kind of second thought. It doesn't seem to have been a main concern if you look in general at the documents and activities of devotees of Buddhism at this time. Secondly, many people appear to have interpreted the concept of transformation into a female body in a particularly positive light, especially in one that valorized mothers, and I'll explain that in a few minutes. And then finally, there were at least some Heian and Kamakura period elites who promoted the idea of the Tushita heaven as a desirable destination for women who wanted to keep their female bodies. So there was this alternative for people who didn't want to, women who didn't want to separate from their female bodies. There was this idea that they could be reborn into the Tushita heaven as women. So that's a very interesting idea. So first, I wanted to examine this idea that these three concepts might not have been as central to people's conception of Buddhism or practices Buddhism as we'd like to think. So the scholar Nomura Ikuyo studied 356 kishinjo, which are statements of donors' intentions in making Buddhist offerings, from this collection called the Kamakura Ibun. So the text is not very clear here, and if you don't read Japanese, I know this might not be very helpful, but this Kamakura Ibun is a collection of historical documents from the Kamakura period. She looked through 356 Ganmon or Kishinjo, these statements, they're kind of like prayer statements, basically, that people would make when they commissioned something, saying what they hope to gain from it. So she looks through 356 of these documents, and she's looking especially for these terms like the five obstacles, the three obediences, transforming the female body into a Buddha, transforming women into men, despising the female body, separating from the female body. She looks for all these terms. And these are the number of times she finds these terms used in documents that were written by or written on behalf of women, in documents that were written by or on behalf of men, and then in total. So what's really amazing is that she finds only about 6% of the 356 documents she looks at actually invoke any of these terms. So in prayers that women were making or that men were making on behalf of women, when commissioning Buddhist objects or rituals, what they were asking for was not being born into a male body or overcoming the five obstacles or the three obediences and so on. What they instead were asking for were the very same things that men were asking for. They were asking for rebirth in the Pure Land. They were asking for the salvation of loved ones. They were often asking for worldly blessings in this life. So Nomura's research here, I think, does a very, I mean, it's very empirical, and I think that's really powerful for showing that, you know, this concept is very, it's something that really sticks in our minds, so when we hear five obstacles and three obediences, we are really interested in looking for it in different pieces of literature and so on. And we think, oh, this was really representative of how people experienced Buddhism at the time. But if we look at this empirically, how many times were people actually mentioning it in documents? It seems like perhaps it wasn't that powerful and it wasn't the main thing that people were concerned with. And then there's a question that's come up. Tata Loka Bikuni, thank you for your question. She says, I was interested in the Hokkeji book. At least some women commissioned Buddhist paintings illustrative of sutras sometimes depicted women directly becoming Buddhas without transforming into men first to do so. Yes, that's absolutely right. So there's an example of, I think what you're referring to are images of the Lotus Sutra, the Devadatta chapter 12, in which the Dragon King's daughter attains Buddhahood. And in the Chinese iconography, it was typical to portray her as a man in this one particular scene after she's transformed into a Buddha. But in Japanese painting, it became very common to portray her as an obviously feminine character. And so that has been analyzed by art historians who've said, well, clearly the Japanese knew about the iconography in the Chinese case, but they changed this and made the dragon girl, kept the dragon girl in her female body and didn't show her in a transformed male body. So this is very much in line with how a lot of the discourse develops in Japan, where educated elite women tend to talk about this episode from the Devadatta chapter as evidence that women don't need to become men before attaining Buddhahood. And that's very interesting because the episode itself is really ambiguous in some ways, although it's pretty clear that she becomes a man before she becomes a Buddha if you read the text. But a lot of Japanese devotees seem to have kind of fudged that part and stressed instead, oh, look, it's possible for a woman to become a Buddha. Okay, so I'm just looking at the notes here. So a good reminder to look at text alongside epigraphy. Sorry. Absolutely. Thank you for these questions. So I'll go ahead and just say a little bit more about these other two points so I don't use up way too much time. So I also wanted to say a little bit about this text called the Tenyo Jobutsu Kyo. So this text literally means transforming women into Buddhas, the sutra on transforming women into Buddhas. And scholars had long assumed that this text, Tenyo Jobutsu Kyo, which is mentioned in a lot of documents from the Heian and Kamakura periods, was a variant of this second text, Busetsu Tenyo Shingyo, which is what the Buddha teaches or preaches, the sutra on the transformation of women's bodies. And in fact, people had assumed that these were the same text to such a degree that even a very recent bibliographic work on the Taisho canon identifies the Tenyo Jobutsu Kyo as the second text, says that they're the same thing. But relatively recently, a scholar named Nishiguchi Junko in Japan has proven that these are in fact two different texts. And it's very important because the content is extremely different. So the Tenyo Shingyo, the second text, which is much longer, focuses on the idea that women, though bound for Buddhahood, must first achieve rebirth into male bodies. Everyone thought that that's what this first text was saying too, but it's not. So the second text, which does show up in the Taisho canon, says women must attain rebirth into male bodies. But in fact, this version of the text, or this text, was never very popular in Japan. This first text, Tenyo Jobutsu Kyo, was in fact very common in Japan, and it has a very unusual content. So we don't know a lot about its provenance, but I want to read you a translation of it. I think this is my translation of the text. It is. So it's very short. I'll just read it to you. It's really interesting. The Buddha preaches the sutra on transforming women into Buddhas. Thus I have heard, once when the Buddha was in Shravasti together with 1,250 people in the great Bhikshu order, Shariputra spoke to the Buddha saying, if we deeply consider women's bodies in the trikilyocosm, not abiding by the precepts, women undergo immeasurable eons of suffering. And thus, Though what causes and conditions might women speedily transform their female bodies and realize the unsurpassed way? At that time, the Buddha told Shariputra, consider this teaching well. As for the causes and effects associated with women's bodies, because all women become the mothers of the Buddhas of the triple world, they are like the great ocean and the great earth. Women's bodies are the storehouses of this Tathagata, of transformation bodies, and of all myriad things. They are the storehouses of the great bodhisattvas, of all good works, and of all great merit. But the karma of breaking the precepts, lacking faith, acting with indolence, having ill will, being jealous, harboring pride, and holding erroneous views, causes them to receive female bodies. When they extinguish the evil karma of previous lives, then they will surely receive the fruit of great bodhisattvahood, and their female bodies will achieve the unsurpassed way. If there is a woman who receives and upholds the three refuges, the five precepts and the 10 major bodhisattva precepts, and does not break them for 7 days or 21 days, or perhaps for 1 month or 2 months or for 49 days, or for 3 months or a half year or 3 years. If a woman receives and upholds these precepts for 6 calendarful cycles and is not sexually licentious, then when the end of her life draws near, bright light will radiate from her body. She will be born in the Western Pure Land, and she will speedily realize the unsurpassed way. If there is a woman who copies this Mahayana Sutra, or reads it aloud, or performs an explanation of it for others, or teaches others to copy and read it aloud, or makes offerings in honor of the sutra and receives and upholds the teachers of the Dharma, bestowing them with offerings and paying them respects, then this woman will extinguish all of the grave karma from immeasurable kalpas of past lives and will achieve the Buddha way. At this time, the Buddha finished preaching the sutra, and the 1,250 members of the great order all rejoiced greatly. So this is a really fascinating sutra, because even though it talks about women having all of these problematic characteristics that have caused them to be born into female bodies, being jealous, harboring pride, holding erroneous views, lacking faith, etc. There are certainly these negative characteristics that are attached to women. But there's also this great praise for women as the mothers of the Buddhas of the triple world. And of course, we can say that's problematic because it's focusing on the biological aspects of being a woman and praising women simply for that. But what's really interesting is that Japanese courtiers and priests picked up on that idea. And so this text, which, though it's not in the Taisho canon, seems to have become very popular. There is a great priest named Chokin, who gave a sermon that is included in the Gyokuyo. So this journal of Kujo Kanezane includes in it a record of a sermon by a monk named, or a priest, who was actually quite an elite priest, named Chokin. And in that, Chokin talks about women being superior to men because they give birth to the Nirmanakaya of bodhisattvas. So it's this really interesting and unusual idea. But Kanezane, the author of the journal who was recording this episode, acknowledges that this is quite a strange idea, but it wasn't so strange that Chokin didn't deliver it. It seems possible that he may have been delivering this as a way of pleasing female patrons, perhaps. But basically he says, I'll just give you a quick reading from this. He says, all women are the true mothers of the Buddhas of the triple world, but it is not the case that all men are the true fathers of all the Buddhas of the triple world. Why is this? Because when a Buddha emerges in the world, he absolutely must reside in a womb temporarily. For example, in the case of a Buddha manifesting himself in a transformation body or Nirmanakaya, it goes without saying that this happens through birth from a womb, but it is not a matter of a father having part in the coming together of yin and yang essences. That is, there's no sexual intercourse involved. In parentheses here, my editorial remarks. The skin and the hair of the body is not received from the father. And thus, because there is no natural principle shared between father and child in this case, can we not conclude that women are superior to men? So this very unusual interpretation, but basically Chokin says that when a bodhisattva comes into the world, Buddha comes into the world as an Nirmanakaya, he has to reside in a womb for a while, and there's some kind of contribution from the mother. But there's no contribution from a father, because the father doesn't take part in this event, right? So the women are the true mothers of the Buddhas of the triple world, but men are not. And so women are superior. So it's very interesting. But that kind of interpretation actually becomes popular in pre-modern Japan. So we have some very kind of creative ways of, in a sense, overriding some of the negative concepts about women facing obstacles on the Buddhist path. And then the final and third idea that I wanted to mention is just that we know that there was also a lot of discourse about women being born in the Tushta heaven, or actually choosing to be born in the Tushta heaven instead of Amitabha's Pure Land, because it was a post-mortem destination or a place of rebirth that didn't require one to shed the female body. So there's actually a iconographic sequence or set of images, I guess we can say, that becomes very popular in Heian Japan, which is that of the Fugen Jūra Setsunyo, this right here. So this, these are the 10 raksha daughters who serve the Bodhisattva Fugen, or Samantha Bhadra, and this discourse, this idea comes from the Lotus Sutra, which emphasizes the vows of the Bodhisattva Fugen or Samantha Bhadra, as they're discussed in the 28th chapter of the Lotus Sutra. And here, Fugen promises that those who simply copy the Lotus Sutra will be born into the heaven of the 33 celestials, or the Tushta heaven. And so it seems that a lot of women became interested in this idea, probably based on that 28th chapter of the Lotus Sutra, of seeking birth in the Tushta heaven. And so we see these beautiful renditions of these Jūra Setsunyo, or the 10 Raksha daughters, serving Fugen. And this is an example here. So here's Fugen, and then we have these beautiful ladies in their court attire, who are the 10 Raksha daughters. And what's really interesting is they're portrayed really as court ladies, and they're beautiful court ladies with their long hair and their flowing robes. And we've had some recent research, some is by a scholar named Kimura Sayako, who has looked at this text called the Wagami ni Tadoru Hime Gimi, which I think I may have on this slide here. This text right here. And she uses this text to show that some ladies-in-waiting at court sought rebirth as ladies-in-waiting in the Tushta heaven. That is, that they saw themselves as kind of the earthly parallels of Samantha Bhadra's 10 Raksha servants, basically. So they wanted to be reborn in the Tushta heaven as court ladies serving Fugen or Samantha Bhadra. So this is kind of a really interesting reinterpretation of, or kind of way around, really, the requirement to give up a female body, because Amitabha's Pure Land, of course, doesn't allow women. There are a lot of passages that talk about, I'm sorry, I missed the question here. Yeah, so in Amitabha's Pure Land, there's this idea that there are no women. There's even one of the vows, the 35th vow of Amitabha. He says that if women despise their female bodies, they will be born as men in the next life. And he promises that they won't have to worry about female birth again. But this trend suggests that there were women who wanted to be born as women again, that by choosing birth in the Tushta heaven instead, or aiming for that instead, might have been a way to really go around this idea that one needed to be reborn as a man to have a good next birth. And there's a lot of supporting evidence in other works as well. There's a work by a monk named Shinkai that I talk about a little bit in the book and some articles that I've written, where he answers a question where people say, what's the difference between the pure line of Amitabha and the Tushita heaven, and which is better? And he says that, well, in the end, the pure line is a little bit better because of its place in the Buddhist cosmos, but there are no women in the pure land and there are women in the Tushita heaven. So he corroborates this idea that, in fact, the Tushita heaven might be a place where women could be born as women. So those were the points I wanted to make, is just that these are several examples where we can see people in actual practice kind of working around a lot of these really negative concepts about the obstacles women face on the Buddhist path. So there were places where people said, hey, women are actually superior to men because they're the mothers of the Buddhas, or women don't have to shed their female bodies, they can be reborn in the Tushita heaven. And then just the fact that if we look at epigraphic evidence, a lot of people didn't seem to be that concerned with these ideas to begin with, and men and women were asking for a lot of similar things. And that's not to dismiss the fact that there were real barriers for women, especially for monastic practice, and there was real patriarchy in Japan and so on. But I just want to emphasize that there were ways for women to work around these ideas and to find agency and to find ways to practice Buddhist devotion in an empowering way and so on. So there's one last question here. How would the woman who committed suicide reunite with her husband in the Pure Land do so? Oh, so this is a good question. So if she chooses birth in the Tushita heaven, I suppose she wouldn't be able to reunite with her husband in the Pure Land. So, we do have a lot of sort of different paradigms that were existing simultaneously, and they don't always match up. So I think the goal of birth in the Pure Land was more common than the goal of birth in Tushita heaven. So we see it more commonly in literature, but there are certainly a lot of examples of women talking about birth in the Tushita heaven also. It may have been more common among court women and women who were especially elite and especially educated. Probably more ordinary women would have only known about the Pure Land, which the practice of Pure Land Buddhism was more widespread than these discussions about birth in the Tushita heaven. I think that was less common. So I have run completely over time. I'm very sorry for that. I hope that the extra discussion will be useful. If there are a couple of questions, I'd be happy to take them. And thank you for indulging me and letting me go on and on. I hadn't talked about a lot of this material in a while, so it took longer than I expected, but I'm now working on Cults to the Blood Bowl Sutra, which Bhikkhu Anna Layo talks about a little bit in one of these articles. He mentions that it is kind of an extreme example of the denigration of the female body in Buddhist discourse. But this is something that became popular late in Japanese, in the medieval period, and then really takes off in the early modern period. And this is the idea that women go to a special hell in recompense for spilling menstrual blood and the blood of childbirth on the earth and polluting earth deities, something that has really no precedent that I can find in any Indian sources, but is invented in China and then comes to Japan in the late medieval period and really takes off and eventually comes to supersede a lot of the standard understandings of women's salvation that had existed in Japan previously. So it's a much more negative view of the female body and of female salvation than what we had seen earlier in Japanese history. But I'm trying to look at it from all angles and to see what women might have found attractive in it, to try to understand why women would have supported that idea and cults to that sutra. And part of what I'm finding is that it was connected to rituals for protection in childbirth, and that may have been attractive to a lot of women, especially lay women, of course. But so that's what I'm working on now, and it's been nice coming back to this earlier material. So thank you so much for your time and for these great questions. I was very happy to have questions during the lecture.